From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Washington Post reports President Trump disclosed highly classified U.S. intelligence when he met with Russian officials last week. Trump's national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, denies the story. So does Russia. President Trump tweets today he was sharing facts about terrorism and airline safety that would help Russia fight ISIS. Is this a dangerous disclosure? Is it true? This hour on Point, what did President Trump say to Russia? Later this hour, we'll look at tough new sentencing guidelines out of the U.S. Justice Department. But first, joining me from Washington is Greg Jaffe, one of the Washington Post reporters who broke the story about Trump's disclosure to Russia. Greg, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So your report says President Trump revealed highly classified information to the Russian ambassador and foreign minister in a meeting in the White House. Tell us more about the content of that information.
You know, we intentionally fuzzed up some of the content because we don't want to compromise intelligence sources and methods. But they were discussing a plot to put put laptops on airplanes that would cause the airplanes to blow up or cause potential were a potential terrorist threat coming out of Syria. I think that the president overstepped in terms of the amount of intelligence he shared about that plot, the varying degrees of damage that it could do, and he overstepped in terms of talking about the precise location of where that plot was being hatched with inside the country of Syria that could potentially allow the Russians to sort of reverse engineer and figure out where the intelligence was coming from.
Here is National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster speaking to reporters outside the White House yesterday, denying your story that President Trump shared this classified information in a meeting last week. Here's that.
The story that came out tonight, as reported, is false. The president and the foreign minister reviewed a range of common threats to our two countries, including threats to civil aviation. At no time, were intelligence sources or methods discussed. And the president did not disclose any military operations that were not already publicly known.
So there is National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster saying at no time were intelligence sources or methods discussed. Your response, Greg Jaffe?
Yeah, I guess I would say, first of all, that the story doesn't say that intelligence sources and methods were discussed. What he discussed that he arguably shouldn't have was information collected from this intelligence stream provided to the United States by a partner that would potentially allow a sophisticated intelligence service like the Russians to work backwards to figure out where that information was coming from. And so he provided enough detail about the information that was collected that a savvy intelligence service could potentially figure out sources and methods.
So let me get this straight. You're saying that McMaster is saying that the thing that didn't happen is something the Post never reported.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think he's choosing his words pretty carefully there.
You quote current and former U.S. officials as sources in this story. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
And who provided this intelligence information to the United States? Do we know?
Yeah, we fuzzed up the exact name of the partner and were asked to protect that relationship. And so that's why we didn't get more specific in the story. We had more specific details, but chosen this particular case to withhold them.
So, but the bottom line is the information was considered so sensitive that details have been withheld even from our allies and tightly restricted even within the U.S. government.
That's right. Yeah. And this particular partner had felt like they'd been burned by the U.S. before and were particularly sensitive to this particular stream of intelligence being shared.
You write in the story, Greg Jaffe, that this is code word information. Trump reveals more information to the Russian ambassador than we have shared with our own allies. So this is terminology that refers to one of the highest classification levels used by American spy agencies? Is that correct?
Right. Yeah, that's right. So there are different sort of, you know, levels of sensitivity. Not all classified information is the same. So you go from, you know, secret to top secret to sort of these code word access level. And And then the levels of, you know, we do collect information that's classified that we distribute to allies. And so they're just different levels of classification, different levels of sensitivity based upon a sort of a range of factors from the partner who's providing it to us or the way we obtained it, you know, the danger that distribution poses to the people who put their lives on the line in some cases to collect this information.
You just said that the president overstepped here. In the story, you write that White House officials in the meeting recognized quickly that the president had overstepped and moved to contain the potential fallout. Tell us more. What do you mean?
Well, they reached out. I guess they did a couple of things. One is, a memo summary of the call that went around within the U.S. government. They made sure that they scrubbed it of references to the things that the president had said that he might not should have. They kept the distribution of the transcript tight, and then they immediately made calls to the National Security Agency and the CIA to kind of let them know what had happened, presumably so that they could mitigate some of the potential downsides from it.
This morning, Connecticut Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal told the Today Show that if President Trump indeed revealed classified information to Russia's ambassador and foreign minister, it would be a significant violation of protocol.
That is a serious breach of norms and rules and may well enable the Russians, who are our adversaries in that part of the world, to trace sources and methods of information. If certain information is disclosed and it can come from only a small number of sources, they can be narrowed down and identified. And that's one of the real threats here.
And here's South Dakota Republican Senator John Thune reacting to the Washington Post story about President Trump sharing classified information in the Oval Office.
Anytime that we're having discussions with the Russians and their sensitive information involved, yeah, that concerns me.
President Trump is tweeting about this morning. Greg Jaffe from the Washington Post, what is he saying?
You know, I think he's tweeted that to suggest that he had shared some information. He's, you know, pretty vague in the tweets about what that information was and that he did it. I believe the word he used, and I'm not looking at the tweet, was for humanitarian purposes. He wanted the Russians to understand the seriousness and the nature of the threat in the hope that it would prod them to work more closely with the United States and in a more constructive fashion, both to eliminate the Islamic State and then to resolve the broader crisis in Syria.
I pulled it up right here. The president said, I have an absolute right to do this, to talk about facts pertaining to terrorism and airline safety. The president does have wide latitude to talk about classified information. I mean, for almost anyone else in government, discussing such matters with an adversary would be illegal. But the president has authority to do that, does he not?
Yeah, absolutely. He does. And there's no question that he does. I guess so it's not illegal. The question is, I guess, whether it's wise or prudent in this particular case and whether it was something that was sort of thought out ahead of time, discussed with experts within the intelligence community, or whether he was freelancing. And I think if it's the latter, then that's certainly troublesome.
What did Russia say about all this?
I'm sorry to say I'm not entirely sure what the Russian response has been this morning. I haven't seen it.
I've seen on Facebook just one bit that said the Russians foreign ministry spokesperson said this is yet another fake. That's a quote, yet another fake. Our allies are responding. Senator Cory Booker, Democrat from New Jersey, members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He said these revelations are appalling and deeply disturbing. Put this into context for us, Greg Jaffe. This allegedly happened one day after Trump fired Director Comey in the midst of this Russia investigation into Trump and collusion with Russia. Put this into context for us.
Yeah, I mean, I think the meeting in and of itself was with the Russian foreign minister and the Russian ambassador, was the timing of it was inopportune. Also inopportune, I think, was the U.S. media was not invited into the meeting, but the Russian news agency TASS distributed photographs of the meeting that took the White House by surprise. I don't think that they wanted public photographs of they announced that the meeting was happening publicly, but they didn't want photos certainly of the president laughing with the foreign minister and the ambassador on the front pages of newspapers around the country, which is what happened. So the timing was really inopportune for them.
In fact, American journalists were not allowed or invited to that meeting. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, it's not unusual or unheard of for the president to meet with the Russian foreign minister. You know, President Obama met with the Russian foreign minister in the Oval Office. I think one could question the wisdom of doing it in the immediate aftermath of firing the FBI director who was overseeing an investigation into sort of Russian meddling in the election. That seems not the smartest move politically.
During a televised town hall meeting on CNN last night, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi said that even if what President Trump told the Russians was in the public domain, it's still an issue to discuss it with an adversary like Russia.
The president could be saying something that's in the public domain, but confirming it to the Russians in a way that is very dangerous. As I say, if it was on purpose, that would be terrible. And if it was not, if it was accidental, that would be very terrible, too.
And Greg Jaffe, a story breaking just now on the Associated Press, not terribly specific, but quotes a European official as saying his country might stop sharing intelligence with the U.S. if Trump indeed gave classified information to Russian diplomats. What's the impact of all of this, Greg Jaffe?
I think that's certainly a worry. You know, the U.S. has the best funded, most sophisticated, and probably the most effective intelligence gathering community in the world. But it does depend heavily on allies and partners, for additional intelligence.
Greg Jaffe, national reporter for The Washington Post. He co-wrote this story about President Trump revealing highly classified information to Russia's foreign minister and ambassador. Greg, thank you very much in the midst of a busy day. Appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks.
When we come back from the break, we will be talking about U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions' message to federal prosecutors. Tougher sentencing, longer prison time. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, a new directive from the Justice Department is loud and clear. Pursue maximum penalties, longer sentences. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions is walking back Obama-era guidelines for federal prosecutors. You can join this conversation. Will the new Sessions policy bring us back to the war on drugs? Will it bring Trump's promised law and order? Joining me from Washington is Matt Zipatusky, covering the Justice Department for The Washington Post. Matt, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having
me. Great to have you. So give us the headline here. What exactly does the Sessions memo do?
Well, what it does is kind of return us to an era when prosecutors are directed to pursue the most serious offense they can, even when that offense triggers a mandatory minimum sentence. So Eric Holder, the previous attorney general, had told prosecutors, charge cases in such a way that we don't hit these mandatory minimum sentences. Jeff Sessions says, we're not doing that anymore. Our job is to enforce the law and enforce the law as vigorously as we can. So in each case, we should charge the most serious but provable offense that we can.
So here is Jeff Sessions, Attorney General, U.S. Attorney General, on Friday announcing this updated charging and sentencing policy for the U.S. Department of Justice.
Going forward, I have empowered our prosecutors to charge and pursue the most serious offense, as I believe the law requires, most serious, readily provable offense. It means that we're going to meet our responsibility to enforce the law with judgment and fairness. It is simply the right and moral thing to do.
And here he is at that same press conference explaining how this updated policy differs from those of his predecessors.
It is important to note that unlike previous charging memoranda, I have given our prosecutors discretion to avoid sentences that would result in an injustice.
So help us understand, Matt, the difference between this policy and those of the past. Is it new or is it just an implementation of rules from, I think, the Bush era, right?
Well, this is definitely new versus the Holder era, but I think what he's referring to there is he's going back even farther and saying prosecutors in previous administrations, their hands were tied to sort of be aggressive. And he's saying if prosecutors down on the line feel like there is a sentence that is going to be unfair, they do have discretion to not bring the most serious charge. But I would note that his memo says they need supervisory approval to do that. They need a U.S. attorney or an assistant attorney general or someone they've designated to okay not going as hard as they can, and they need to document in the file reasons. So, you know, he is giving them discretion, that's true, but the discretion comes with sort of strings attached.
Here he is on Friday again, Jeff Sessions, saying that the U.S. is seeing an increase in violent crime across the country, and a lot of that violence is tied to drug trafficking.
We know that drugs and crime go hand in hand. They just do. The facts prove that so. Drug trafficking is an inherently dangerous and violent business. If you want to collect a drug debt, you can't file a lawsuit in court. You collect it with the barrel of a gun.
And in his inaugural address on January 20th, President Trump described a nation in pain, ravaged by poverty, a broken education system, and drug-related crime.
And the crime, and the gangs, and the drugs that have stolen too many lives and robbed our country of so much unrealized potential. This American carnage stops right here and stops right now.
There's President Trump, Matt, speaking about American carnage, about the crime and the gangs. Jeff Sessions has said repeatedly that he sees the uptick in violent crime in many U.S. cities as the start of a, quote, dangerous trend. Tell us about that. What are the statistics that you're seeing out there?
Well, Jeff Sessions is not wrong that crime is increasing. And the latest FBI data, which was for the first half of 2016, so a little bit out of date now, but the latest that they have, violent crime was up 5%. Jeff Sessions likes to cite this statistic that homicides in 2015 were up 10% over the year before. So he's not wrong that crime is increasing. But crime is at historic lows. I mean, if you go back to the 80s and 90s, the late 80s, early 90s, homicides now are half of what they were then. So Jeff Sessions is worried, I guess, that we're getting on the path to get back to those days. And crime is increasing, but we're nowhere close to where we once were.
So tell us about how these guidelines have historically affected prison populations, how those harsher sentences and sentencing strategies, what they did to grow the prison population in this country.
Yeah, I think it's pretty simple that they grew the prison population, that the prison population swelled. And the Justice Department is fully prepared for that. I mean, they expect this to be a return to days when more people went to prison for longer. They haven't projected out exactly what that would look like in terms of hard numbers. But I would note that earlier this year, Jeff Sessions, the previous Justice Department had wanted to get out of the business of using private prisons. Jeff Sessions said, no, we need to keep using those because we expect the private prison population will, or the, excuse me, the prison population in general will grow, and we need to use those private prisons because of that.
Let me bring two more voices into this conversation. From Washington, Bill Otis, a former assistant U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Virginia from 1981 to 1999. He also served on the Attorney General's Advisory Committee on Sentencing Guidelines after the Sentencing Reform Act passed in 1984. He's now an adjunct professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center. Bill, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also in Washington, we have Todd Cox, the director of policy at the NAACP's Legal Defense and Educational Fund. He's worked for years as a civil rights litigator and policy advocate, and previously served as the director of criminal justice policy at the Center for American Progress. Welcome to you, Todd. Great to have you.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Bill Otis, I'll speak with you first. As a former prosecutor, what is your reaction to the new Sessions memo, these new sentencing guidelines?
I think the Sessions memo is the right move because essentially what it says is that prosecutors should charge the defendant with what he did. That's what we expect prosecutors to do. It also improves upon the policy that had preceded it, which told prosecutors in that when they wrote the indictment to kind of shuffle off behind the curtain the actual amount of drugs the defendant had been involved with. My view of it is that that was wrong, that what we should have prosecutors doing is tell the whole truth to the court from the get-go. And Jeff Sessions has now returned that. I might add, if I could, that while we are near historic lows in crime, that's precisely because we've made greater use of incarceration, we've had more proactive policing, so we are near those lows. But in the last 2 years, 2015 and 2016, we have had two consecutive years of increases in violent crime for the first time in decades. So this is a time not to be complacent, but to restore the policies that had helped give us lower crime over a generation.
So Todd Cox, NAACP, jump in here. There you hear Bill Otis say this is the right move. This improves previous policies. How do you see it?
Well, we see it as absolutely the wrong move, and it's turning back the clock on years of bipartisan criminal justice reform at the state and federal level, and threatens to return us, as someone said earlier, to the war on drugs, the discredited policies of the war on drugs, which had devastating impacts on all of our communities, but particularly African-American and Latino communities. We know that African-Americans are 13% of the population, but 40% of the prison population. One in three folks have criminal records. 5 million children have a parent with a criminal record. 1 in 9 of those children are African American. The impacts of all of this are devastating. And to have sentencing charges return us back to the days of the Ashcroft era, which resulted in all of this, is devastating. I also want to say that there's really no justification based on the so-called increase in crime. We know that there have been increases in murder rates, but the overall increase in violent crime has been concentrated in three major urban areas, and that they're responsible for over half of that increase. And as it has been said before, we're still seeing historic lows in the crime rate, and that's still trending down.
Mm. Bill Otis, what about a piece of this? Former Attorney General Eric Holder said that mandatory minimum sentences only led to bloated, costly prisons and disproportionately impacted minority communities. Todd Cox mentioned that briefly. What do you say to that point?
I would say that what the most serious thing that disproportionately impacts African Americans is the high murder rate. We had a very high murder rate, twice what it is now, in 1991, before we began, under both President Bill Clinton and President George Bush. This was the bipartisan agreement that we should do something about the crime problem we had. Mandatory minimum sentencing to rein in naive or ideological judges was one part of that, as was more aggressive policing and greater use of incarceration. Crime fell to the levels we have now for a reason. And the reason, part of the reason, was that mandatory minimums did put criminals where they couldn't harm civil society, and that is what we have seen happen.
So, Todd Cox, to that point, Attorney General Sessions says that prosecutors will now be unhandcuffed, his words, unhandcuffed and not micromanaged from Washington. Isn't that a good thing?
Well, we think that's not a good thing, and we would challenge the notion that under Eric Holder's Smart on Crime initiative that prosecutors were handcuffed. In fact, what Jeff Sessions has done is return us back to an era where prosecutors have absolutely no discretion to look at the background of the individual, to actually do what Congress intended behind all of these so-called tough on crime bills, which was to actually get the kingpins, to get the big guy. Unfortunately, what happened over the decades was that they focused on everyone, and that's what we're going to do now. We're going to get low-level, nonviolent drug offenders back into the system, or continue to do that, and increase the number of prisoners in our nation's prisons. I also want to say that it's important not to patronize the African-American community. I think the African-American community does want safe communities. One way to get that is to make sure our police and African-American communities have restored trust among each other. And we would hope that the Sessions administration and the Trump administration would rethink the fact that they're turning their backs on policing reform and help restore that trust. That's how you help reduce the crime rate. You also help reduce the crime rate by removing barriers to folks when they reenter society, offering opportunities for jobs, housing, employment, education that reduce or eliminate the possibility of recidivism. recidivism. Mm-hmm. So African Americans can chew gum and walk at the same time. We both can ask for the police and the government to protect us, but also demand that they did not stereotype us and actually over-incarcerate.
Let me get some callers in here. A lot want to join this conversation. Jenny first in Kennebunkport, Maine. Hi, Jenny. Glad you called. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. Jane. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
You know, the one thing that gets to me about this is the fact that we're bringing back the private prisons in larger quantities with this ruling, and that it's going back to the stop and frisk. That's the one thing. So it really, to me, pinpoints a certain group of people, Blacks, Hispanics, minorities. That's the first thing. The second thing, this idea that drugs are only coming across the border and affecting us, when in fact the drug companies and the doctors are prescribing the opioids that are really, really distributed mm-hmm. and really destroying our environment.
Two good questions, Jenny. I'm going to actually bring Matt Zapatowski back in here. Speak to those two points, Matt. Does this pinpoint certain groups, this new memo from Jeff Sessions? And what about the opioid crisis? How does that affect all this?
I think definitely the opioid crisis is one of the things that he is focused on here. He's concerned about drugs generally, even down to marijuana, but heroin most significantly. And he sees this as a deterrent. If you can bust big-time drug dealers who have high quantities of heroin, that will reduce crime, in his view. The caller raised a point about stop and frisk. Jeff Sessions, it seems like, certainly is in favor of those aggressive on-the-street policing policies, but this memo is separate from that. This is sort of at the prosecutorial stage.
What about nonviolent offenders, the minimum mandatories that affect, you know, people that do have a drug issue? The opioid crisis is causing a lot of, you know, people to go to jail that wouldn't otherwise, right?
Well, so you're right. Jeff Sessions would say to that, and I think a lot of federal prosecutors would say to that, look, we're the feds. We handle the most serious cases. And even if there might not be a weapon that we can prove was involved, these are big drug organizations if we're taking the case federally. And so they should trigger these mandatory minimums. I think the other side would say, that's not quite right. You can definitely wrap in lower level offenders in big cases. And if you don't sort of use real keen discretion, you're gonna hit people with unfair sentences and have low-level nonviolent people in jail for a long time, 10 years on the low end.
Is that a concern, Bill Otis?
Having been a federal prosecutor for 18 years, I can tell you that the feds concentrate both on hard drugs, not marijuana, hard drugs like heroin, methamphetamine, increasingly now. A new drug called fentanyl, which is even worse than heroin. And just as we did in the 1990s under Bill Clinton and after that under George Bush, we should adopt the policies that have succeeded in bringing down crime so low. As to the point that prosecutors will no longer have discretion, I just disagree with that completely. If you look at the Sessions memo, prosecutors do continue to have discretion in unusual cases to charge below a mandatory minimum. The difference is now that prosecutors will have to do something that we always should insist that they do, which is document the reasons for their departure and have them approved by a more experienced attorney. We won. More accountability and more transparency from prosecutors, and that's what we'll be getting now.
So, Todd Cox, do you agree with that? Do you worry about discretion of prosecutors?
I worry. I just have the same concern I expressed before. I think we have to look at this in context, right? We have a president who has, as you mentioned before, espoused so-called law and order principles, issued executive orders in that regard. They have turned their back on policing reform. I think that all of that within the context of prosecutors exercising their discretion really indicates that they have a mandate not to actually seek the unusual circumstances where they would depart from what Jeff Sessions has mandated.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. Today we're talking about the new set of sentencing guidelines from the U.S. Department of Justice that would hit drug offenders with stiff charges and lengthy sentences. You can join the conversation. Is this a step in the right direction? Do we need to crank up our prosecution efforts? We're speaking this hour with Matt Zapatosky, Justice Department reporter for The Washington Post, Bill Otis from Georgetown University Law Center. He served as an assistant U.S. attorney and as a special counsel to President George H.W. Bush, and with Todd Cox, Director of Policy at the NAACP's Legal Defense and Education Fund. Yesterday, President Trump spoke during a memorial service for fallen police officers at the U.S. Capitol, where he and his administration was committed. He said he was committed to bringing violent criminals, drug dealers, and gang members to justice.
We've seen the unbearable horror of the shortcomings in Baltimore and Chicago that have cut short so many lives and so many beautiful, beautiful dreams. We cannot stand for such violence. We cannot tolerate such pain. We cannot, under any circumstances, any longer, turn a blind eye to the suffering that's going on any longer, and we won't.
And here's President Obama. In 2015, he became the first sitting U.S. president to visit a federal prison when he went to the El Reno Federal Correctional Institution just outside of Oklahoma City. He told reporters that the United States accounts for 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's prison inmates.
A primary driver of this mass incarceration phenomenon is our drug laws, our mandatory minimum sentencing around drug laws. And you know, we have to consider whether this is the smartest way for us to both control crime and rehabilitate individuals. This is costing taxpayers across America $80 billion a year.
And here is then Attorney General Eric Holder speaking to the American Bar Association in San Francisco in August 2013, saying that the U.S. prison population is unnecessarily large and that needs to change.
Today, a vicious cycle of poverty, criminality, and incarceration traps too many Americans and weakens too many communities. And many aspects of our criminal justice system may actually exacerbate these problems rather than alleviate them. It's clear as we come together today that too many Americans go to too many prisons for far too long and for no truly good law enforcement reason.
Let's go to our listeners in Dayton, Ohio first. Here's Aaron. Hi, Aaron. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for having me.
Yes, go ahead.
Jane, I'd just like to bring up two different topics. One, talking about incarceration. Originally, when jails were started, incarceration was supposed to be a rehabilitation process. And we're supposed to rehabilitate people, not just cast them off from society. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the ideas of could we ever get back to that rather than just putting people away from society, maybe doing it as a rehabilitation, what it was originally meant to be. I know we'd have to change the mentality of our society in general for that, unfortunately, so it would be a long time. But I would just like to hear their thoughts on that. My second point was I work in an emergency room setting, and I've worked in there for 8 years. And in that time, we have seen multiple problems with hardcore drugs. With that said, very, very, very small percentages of those people, and in my experience, are African-American. Most of them are white. Can they just talk about the disparity between the whites being put in jail for those things rather than the blacks? From what we are seeing, it's not just a problem with African-Americans, and yet African-Americans are being targeted and put in jail at much higher rates than whites.
Aaron, thank you very much for the call from Dayton. Bill Otis, you're a former U.S. attorney, prosecutor. Speak to this, the disparity in these issues.
There is also a disparity, and indeed a more stark disparity, in the amount of men rather than women we have in prison. There is a disparity in terms of age. Many more young people go to prison. The reason for that is not that the country or the criminal justice system likes to target men or youth. The reason is that there is more criminal behavior coming from men and youth. It's the behavior that the system focuses upon, and not
But I think
their
Aaron's
race.
Point is the disparity, the racial disparity here between whites and blacks. Todd Cox, will you speak to that?
Sure. I think she's right on point, and I think it's best illustrated with how we dealt with criminal justice reform efforts in the last Congress. We spent many years, and it culminated, unfortunately, in not getting anywhere, on creating something called the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act, which was trying to turn back the clock or actually eliminate mandatory minimums or refocus mandatory minimums on the most serious criminals, the most serious and violent individuals. But, you know, when the opioid crisis reappeared, it became clear that that particular crisis was going to be dealt with as a health problem. And we applauded that. However, we were concerned and actually curious as to why back in the 80s the drug problem or the crack problem that was permeating throughout the African-American community was not seen as a health problem and was not welcomed or not addressed in a way any other way other than criminality. Mm-hmm. So I think Aaron is exactly right, and hopefully we'll see some reckoning of that. To her first point, though, I think returning to the purpose of prison to in some ways rehabilitate folks, prepare them to come out as whole people is something, again, that we tried to achieve with this Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act. There was hopefully going to be opportunities in that bill to allow folks to earn time to earn early release upon satisfying a number of conditions and rehabilitating themselves. Unfortunately, the bill went nowhere, ultimately.
Matt Zepetowski, jump back in here. What about that point that Aaron brings up, prison reform to encourage rehabilitation through job training, through housing needs, education, mental health, so many issues?
You know, Loretta Lynch, the attorney general in between Eric Holder and Jeff Sessions, was really focused on that issue, people reentering society and giving them the tools they would need to actually establish a life outside of prison. I don't know that Jeff Sessions isn't focused on that, but he seems to be much more focused on the aspect of prison that has nothing to do with rehabilitation, the aspect of prison that is sort of a deterrent. You know, you will go to prison for a long time, so then you'll be deterred from committing a crime. And I guess the aspect of prison that's just focused on this innate sense of justice, you know, you should be punished when you do wrong. Jeff Sessions seems much more focused on those aspects of sending people to prison than on the making them better and, you know, making society better.
Let's go to Jim in Sarasota, Florida. Hi, Jim. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I just wanted to maybe offer a few things. I told your call screener there that I'm what you probably would have called a career criminal. I've done state and federal time, and my last sentence was, I was sentenced in 1991 to 132 months. I was released in 2000 and become, I guess, the model citizen ever since. But obviously it took me quite a few years to reach that point. But I did see a lot, you know, direct the results of the mandatory minimums and that kind of thing. And you know, I just think that, you know, my perspective, I think, is a little different than what I'm hearing some of the people, professionals talk about.
And so what do you make of the new Jeff Sessions guidelines based on, you know, you spent 9.5 years in prison, you did time, mandatory minimum. What do you think about what he's doing, Jim?
Well, I'm not an expert, but in my opinion, I think, once they federalized a lot of things, it's just enforcing the law. You can quibble with the mandatory minimums in certain instances, but really, like I said, as someone that, you know, committed a lot of crime, you know, you just get away with a lot, and then especially in state court, you know, you plea bargain, and you do this and do that, and you're right back out to do it again. And
I guess the question is, are stricter sentences deterrents, Jim?
I believe so, yes, but I also believe maturity and being fed up with doing time is also a deterrent.
I so appreciate you calling. Thanks very much, Jim. Good luck to you. What do you say, Bill Otis? Do you see stricter sentences as deterrents?
I find myself in the odd position of very much agreeing with Jim and what he has said. It's any parent who has a, you know, a 10-year-old or 12-year-old knows that punishment does deter. The criminal justice system, not just under Jeff Sessions, but since the country was founded, has known that deterrence is one feature of punishment. We do want rehabilitation if we can get it. Unfortunately, under Eric Holder, and to be honest, under the attorneys general before him, both Republican and Democrat, we have seen not successful rehabilitation, but a very high recidivism rate. Eric Holder did a study released in 2014 of recidivism rates, and it's startling and very bad news. 82% of property offenders reoffend when they get out of prison, 77% of drug offenders, and 71% of violent offenders. With recidivism statistics like that, just to improve public safety, we should not be looking to lower sentences. We know what works and we know what fails. We had a failing system and an explosion of crime in the 60s, 70s, and part of the 80s. We have had a plummeting of crime since the late 80s until almost the present day. And we know what we've done to get it. Increased incarceration, along with more proactive policing and reining in judges, has been a big part of the mix in the success we've had over the last generation, so, and compares wonderfully with the failures we had when we had a more feckless and naive belief about what we should do about crime.
So, Todd Cox, you hear Bill Otis's statistics there. They're pretty clear.
Well, actually, it's not as clear as one would think. I think it's important not to create spurious connections. Longer sentences do not result in public safety, do not result in a reduction in crime. There was a study done by the U.S. Commission, Sentencing Commission, that found that defendants released early were not more likely to reoffend than prisoners who served their whole sentence. We also know that by a study done by the Brennan Center, the diminishing crime rate over time was due to rising incomes, an aging population, a myriad of other kinds of social economic factors. So this high incarceration rate, incarcerating millions of Americans, has essentially had a zero impact on our crime rate. And I think, I'm sorry, in terms of recidivism, if we really are serious about addressing that issue, we need to look at the barriers associated with having a criminal record. We know that if you have a job, if you have a house, if you have an education, you're far less likely to recidivate. And from this administration, we've seen absolutely nothing on this point. And we've only seen not even half of a solution to a problem.
I got to get Elaine in here from Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, Elaine, you're on the air. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
Yes.
I just had a quick comment to make. I grew up under these policies, and both of my parents went to prison for what you would pretty much be a little bit more than personal use for drugs, and it therefore split our entire family apart. We grew up in foster care in the system. Two siblings went to prison. We were exposed to shady elements within that for-profit foster care system. I've been clean for 5 years and doing well in my life, and it just is like a nightmare revisited hearing these old, archaic policies are going to be championed back into play.
So the tougher sentences are not effective, Elaine? Is that what you're saying, bottom line?
Yeah, they're not. They're not. Absolutely not. It tears families apart when your parents come back out of prison. You're a different person. You don't know your parents anymore. They can't get gainful employment. It's just, I think people need to really think about how this impacts an entire family other than just putting somebody away and being tough on drugs because it doesn't work.
Elaine, thank you very much for the call from Des Moines. Matt Zapatowski, that's the ripple effect right there, I guess you're hearing from Elaine.
Yeah, and I think you can see it sort of between her and the previous caller both ways. I mean, when people go to prison for a long time, this has effects outside of just the person who goes to prison. If they have children, it affects the children. If they have a spouse, it affects the spouse. When they get out, if they have trouble getting a job, it might foster a sense of hopelessness and might lead them back to a life of crime. On the other hand, you heard from one caller who sort of suggested, you know, look, I do think longer prison sentences are a deterrent. I went to prison. I would also note with him, when he got out, it sounds like he was much older. So just being in prison at a time when he might have been tempted to commit crimes, he gets out and he's just more mature. I think the prosecutors would say that's evidence that you do need longer sentences. But, you know, the last caller is right. These long prison sentences don't just affect the person who goes to prison.
House Speaker Paul Ryan, among other Republicans, have pushed for bipartisan criminal justice reform on Capitol Hill. Matt Zapatowski, how do you see Attorney General Jeff Sessions' new guidelines affecting that bipartisan effort that's been going now for a few years?
Well, when he was a senator, he opposed that. I mean, he has very hard-line views on this subject, sort of on the far right even of his own Republican Party. You know, he also says, though, that he would enforce the law. One of his pitches here is the law says we need to charge crimes this way, so let's do that. Let's not sort of legislate from the Attorney General's office. I imagine if Congress did pass some sort of reform, he would be bound by those comments and he would have to enforce the new laws that Congress passes.
10 seconds to close this up, Bill Otis and Todd Cox. How do you see the immediate impact of Jeff Sessions' new rules in the Justice Department? How do you see that impacting us right away? Bill Otis, you first.
I think a restoration of the policies that were successfully used by Bill Clinton and to some extent initiated by Bill Clinton and George Bush will put us back on the road to reducing crime, which we had for so many years under those two presidents, rather than increasing crime, which we've had over the last 2 years when President Obama and Loretta Lynch were in charge.
Todd Cox, 10 seconds for you.
I would hope that the states would not follow suit the way they did with the war on drugs and the 1994 Crime Act. They've been leading the way on criminal justice reform, reestablishing the proper appointment of mandatory minimums on most serious criminals, and we hope that they continue that practice and do not follow the lead of the federal government in this instance.
Todd Cox, NAACP Legal Defense Education Fund. Thanks so much, Todd. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bill Otis, professor at Georgetown University Law Center. Thank you, professor. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And Matt Zapatowski from The Washington Post. Really appreciate your time and your reporting on this, Matt. Thank you.
Great to be with you.
Informative Hour listeners, thank you very much for calling. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.